I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Steve is our engineer. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As moles, we seek to explore alternative solutions to social and political problems that fall outside the capitalist paradigm of our elected officials, the Obama administration, though progressive in some ways, being no exception. Bill Resnick will lead off today's program interviewing Leo Panitch. They will be talking about this very subject, the severe problems capitalism currently faces, the limitations of Obama's response, and possible openings this leaves for the left. Leo Panitch is a Marxist professor of political science at York University in Toronto, Ontario, and editor of the Socialist Register. If you follow pop culture at all, you are aware of the singer Rihanna being physically assaulted by her musician boyfriend, Chris Brown. Fran Michel is here to discuss that sordid event and the problem of dating violence in general. I'll be giving a eulogy for Archie Green, a well-known union activist and folklorist who died a week ago Sunday in San Francisco. Rounding out today's program, Laurie Mercier will be talking with Georges Lizarraga, who is a diversity faculty fellow at WSU Vancouver on loan from UC Berkeley, and is finishing a study on the impact of urban design theories and city planning policies on the racial and ethnic demography of Portland. But right now, here's Bill talking with Leo Panitch.
Thanks, Tom. Leo Panitch, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Bill.
Leo Panitch is a Canadian, writes and teaches about the U.S. and global system. He's a really big thinker, a sober thinker, but sees visionary possibilities. Leo Panitch, Barack Obama has been reading history about Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Obama and the administration apparently see themselves as having to save the Union and the capitalist system, too. Is this just political posturing, political positioning? How do you see the current crisis and the Obama administration's efforts so far?
Well, I think they are cast in the role that Roosevelt was to some extent in the 1930s, that is, of saving capitalism. And although Roosevelt, by 1936, was being called a socialist and even worse, a communist by many people in business, many people on Wall Street, he explicitly was oriented to saving capitalism and made no bones about that. And Obama is in much the same situation in what is the most severe economic crisis since the 1930s. The difference may be that it now looks like Roosevelt was rather more prepared to step on capitalist toes than Obama is. He was prepared, for reasons we could talk about, or was pushed at any rate in the 1930s, to do things that he thought were necessary to save capitalism that the capitalists with a much narrower perspective didn't like. Obama doesn't seem to be capable of asserting, either on his own or because of the people he surrounded himself with, asserting that degree of independence from the capitalist class in the United States.
You're referring then to the crisis in finance and the banking system and the absolute need to restructure it, yet he seems to be relying on a lot of the same old guys who have kept their positions and their bonuses.
Yes, and he seems very frightened that to do anything that might undermine their confidence further. So even though the banking system is completely dysfunctional, even though we can see that it serves a completely social purpose and that the whole economy is dependent on it, but nevertheless is held in private hands, and in the hands really of very few people, he doesn't seem ready or capable of going beyond that to turn the financial system into a public utility. The result of that is that both the American economy and really the world economy is frozen by virtue of the fact that private debt, bank lending is frozen, and is just not profitable for bankers, and they see it as too dangerous for them to be engaging in lending. And the stimulus program, no matter how rich, won't have the kind of effect that people hope it will have unless it is multiplied by lending through the banking system.
What is the alternative to Obama's reliance on and really pleading with the bankers to begin lending again, which they aren't doing for actually good banking reasons?
That's
right. You really don't know
the
health
value of the assets they're holding.
Right, and the whether these companies or people or whoever you're lending to will survive the downturn.
That's right. And they're even afraid, let alone subprime mortgages and all of the derivatives built on them, they're increasingly afraid that the corporate bonds that they hold will be defaulted on, or the third world private or public bonds that they're holding will be defaulted on as trade collapses, as profits in the third world collapse, and so on. In that context, he is a prisoner of the reluctance of the banking system, having, you know, led us into this mess, to now get us out of it. And the alternative would be to indeed nationalize the whole banking system. Now, most people on the left in the United States then say, nationalize it, eat up the bad debt, and then sell it back after the public sector has eaten up the bad debt, has socialized the debt, as one can say. Give it back to the private bankers. That's what was done in Japan in the late 90s, in Sweden in the early 90s. But in fact, that is a extremely undemocratic way to go. And what I would say this provides us with an opportunity with is to finally take this crucial element of our society into the democratic domain, into the public domain, and change the criteria upon which banking and really the decisions about what's to be invested, where it's to be invested, how it's to be invested, to finally take those decisions into the democratic public arena.
It's going to be a long time, though, before, it seems to me, the administration, they're going to have to be driven into it, and the American people are going to take your advice. It's not inconceivable, though, that they will be driven into it if the crisis keeps deepening and if the population gets more desperate and worried. It's important to talk about that right now, the necessity of it, and also the great potentials of it. How do we do that?
Well, it's not going to happen without tremendous pressure from below for it to happen. And that can come from a very, very wide variety of sources, from, you know, the workers who are not only being laid off but are being forced to reopen their contracts with the auto companies, even while the managers in the banks and the insurance companies hold on to their million-dollar bonuses on the grounds that they have contracts. But it doesn't only apply to working people who see the hypocrisy and the essential class nature of that. It also applies to small businessmen. It applies to professionals. It applies to people very broadly in the middle class who increasingly in this crisis can come to see how dependent they are on the decisions of a small group of private bankers. But it would need a tremendous amount of pressure from below. And what Roosevelt did that was really reformist during the New Deal, and it did make a difference to people's lives, was done under that kind of pressure. It was done under the mobilizations of the unemployed, the enormous mass mobilizations of people in the labor sector, which led to the great unionization reforms of the 1930s and so on. There was also a radicalization in the universities and in the media, which pushed all of this. Some of those people found their way with these radical ideas into the Roosevelt administration. But it was pressure from the outside as much as from the in, really more from the in, that pushed him in this direction. Mm-hmm. Now, Obama has called for people to put pressure on him. And one would hope that those people who were so active through the internet and in door-to-door campaigns would be putting pressure on him now after the election. We'll have to see the extent to which that happens.
Yeah, I wonder if that call for pressure, even if very sincere, and I suspect it may well be, it doesn't in fact take some of the pressure off, because those people who would have to be applying the pressure are hearing from him that somehow he's on their side. I'm working for you. Please. We'd almost be better off putting pressure on George W. Bush, at least in the United States now.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very good point.
Yeah. And then we 3.4 million people last week were on the streets in France protesting and challenging the government and frightening them to death.
Yeah.
It's not happening in the United States.
I think that's a very good point. But that also has to do, of course, with the decrepit nature of the American labor movement and the lack of organizational coherence of the American left. The French are capable of pulling off these one-day general strikes, and this one was bigger than usual given the context of the crisis. Nevertheless, they're capable of pulling these off because the left is far better organized, both in the labor movement and more generally in politics, than the North American left is in general. And what this is going to require is a transformation of the nature of trade unionism in the United States, some of which there are signs of it taking place in certain sectors, not least in California and out on the West Coast generally, but also via new political organizations. And there again, you could say, the hope that's been invested in a resurgence of the Democratic Party as a spokesman for working people and so on may delay that. On the other hand, it's to be hoped, and this was the case in the 60s, that as with the Kennedy-Johnson years, that this will give a fillip to movements and to political organization and political radicalism rather than be a damper on it. And that's what did happen in the 60s.
Leo Panitch, this is KBOO Radio. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Leo Panitch. He's done many wonderful books, lots of essays, one called The Globalization Decade, a book. A second, Renewing Socialism, Democracy, Strategy, and the Imagination. We've been talking about the economic crisis, the Obama administration's efforts that so far have been probably not commensurate with the degree of the problem, and also talking about the possibilities of big movements in the United States. Leo Panitch, your assessment of sort of the U.S. left and the labor movement, seeing them both as quite anemic and disorganized and unable to actually lead the kinds of struggles that would be necessary, that implies, though, that there's still something there, clearly, and But it implies that it's going to take a while, and it may well be that we're going to have some time, because this crisis is likely to get worse, although one can never tell. Soothsaying is not our strong suit. But it does look very serious, and they're not going to be able to reconstitute in the old way. Am I right about that? It seems the financial bubble that kept the economy going for various bubbles for 25 years are not going to be reconstituted. Do you see that sort of long-term, it's going to be a long-term struggle that in fact, progressives can work in?
Yes, I think it is. I think that we have time, if you want to put it that way.
Unfortunately, yes.
Yes, that's right. I mean, a lot of people are going to suffer as a result. Yes, I see this as a very, very serious crisis, and one that is going to last and that there's no easy way out of. And it is necessary, as you're implying, that people have patience in that context, and that they do come up with short-term reforms, immediate reforms, as well as generate a long-term vision and be open about the inadequacy of the short-term reforms. So, for instance, Bernie Sanders just last week called for a cap on interest rates on credit cards. And what we indeed are seeing is that the extent to which the American economy depended on working people, middle-class people, living on credit in a context where their incomes had been constrained for so long since the 1970s. They were able to keep up their standard of living through credit. And they now are in a situation where, although the interest that banks are paying if you put $5 into an account is practically zero, they're charging people 20, 30, 40, 50% on their credit cards as people can't afford to pay off the minimum debt. And Saunders has introduced a piece of legislation in the Congress that would put a 15% cap on these usurious payments. And that's good. That's a good thing. But it also speaks to the enormous inequity of that reform, that what is considered to be a good thing is that people should be paying 15% interest to the very banks that themselves are giving practically no interest to money put into the banking system. So they're making a profit, if you like, of 15 times what they're paying out. That should show the necessity of the reform and the inadequacy of it. And people ought to struggle for that reform and then struggle for far, far more radical alternatives of the kind I was speaking of in terms of banking being a public utility. Mm-hmm. Those things are possible to combine in a political mobilization. And hopefully that is going to happen. And you can see that across the board in those areas where you're seeing a collapsing industrial sector. Let's take the auto sector. It is necessary to secure the kind of supports to keep plants in operation that are essential to their communities. But at the same time, it's necessary to be calling for, in the auto sector, for instance, the taking of that whole auto sector into the public arena. If you like, the nationalization of the auto companies and the parts companies, and their conversion into the production of things that people are really going to need, which is not private cars run on oil, on gasoline, on a fossil economy, if you like, but rather modes of transportation that are energy efficient, whether it's hydrogen or electricity. But more than that, the conversion of that industry into the production of things like solar panels to produce cheap solar energy, which is going to have to come in the next generation and can come with enough investment in technological change.
Yeah. Even, in fact, if government now is not ready, in fact, to basically nationalize, although they have in some ways, and just sacked the president of GM today, but if they're not willing to nationalize and, in fact, are probably going to be trying to move GM towards clean cars and somewhat new energy system rather than, in fact, really converting into a very different kind of energy system and doing wind turbines and many other sort of necessary infrastructure elements, if they're not ready to do that now, they may well be in 2 or 3 years if we, in fact, keep maintaining the pressure and build that vision. I gather that's the way you see it.
It's perhaps a bit more optimistic than I am about where they'll be 2-3 years from
right.
now.
Or 5 years or 8 years. And it seems to me all of American life now, the health system, the justice system, the energy system, there's nothing that isn't in contest now in the certainly the financial system, as you discussed.
Yeah.
Everything now is being questioned and in contest. It's really an enormous, to quote Rahm Emanuel, I know you agree with that, a really deep crisis, a terrible thing to waste. We can put a left vision on the agenda now for the first time in a long time.
I entirely agree with that. And I would say something else about American political culture. There is a tendency on the part of the intellectual American left, at least, and the labor leadership, to think that what the United States has missed has been the Canadian or European type of labor or social democratic party. And it's my feeling, and I felt it for a long time, that that's mistaken, that those types of social democratic and labor parties are extremely hidebound, afraid of their own shadow, very much themselves caught within the limits of the system. And there may be something quite liberating to the fact that the United States doesn't have that heavy tradition. And it may very well be possible that the American left could blow past European social democracy to something that is more democratic, that builds in a positive way on the populist and progressive tradition in the United States. And it would be a mistake, I think, although I think this is going to be most common, partly because at least of the public health care debate,
right,
which social democracy gave us and not
Leo,
you.
I'm afraid we're going to have to, I'm getting the signal that that we have to end.
Well, as we said, we've got lots of time.
We have time, and people are actually enthused. There is a vision. Thanks a lot for talking to us today.
Good to talk to you, Bill.
Right. So long.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Dating violence is back in the news again with a recent assault by musician Chris Brown on his singer girlfriend Rihanna. Fran Michelle is here to discuss this perennial problem that only seems to get much public attention when the rich and famous are involved.
If there's one good thing about the publicity surrounding pop singer Chris Brown's arrest on felony assault charges for an incident that left pop singer Rihanna with visible injuries, it's that it's raised awareness about violence in intimate relationships, and especially dating violence among young people. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, each year in the U.S., about 4.8 million women and 2.9 million men are physically assaulted by an intimate partner. The gender disparity increases with the level of violence. Of those killed by an intimate partner, three-quarters are women. Similarly, for teens, 1 in 11 adolescents reports being a victim of physical dating violence, and 1 in 5 high school girls has been physically or sexually abused by a dating partner. This sort of information has been much more widely disseminated in recent weeks. Even the New York Times has written about the issue, reporting that nearly 10% of teenagers report being hit or slapped by a boyfriend or girlfriend, and quoting Dr. Elizabeth Miller of the University of California Davis School of Medicine, who states that the numbers of girls who sustain serious injuries and the sexual violence sustained against girls is much higher than for boys. But there may be such a thing as bad publicity, and I say that not just because the Times put the story in their fashion and style section, and not even just because the release of the battered woman's name and photo was a breach of her privacy. I say it because, as the staff at Alternet also note, most of the dialogue surrounding the incident hasn't done much to advance an intelligent, empathetic discussion about the problem. In addition to the initial statements of support for Brown, there's been a good deal of blame and criticism of Rihanna, especially following reports that she's continued her relationship with him. Given the nature of public discourse on this subject, we shouldn't be that surprised by the results of a widely reported survey of 200 teenagers by the Boston Public Health Commission, in which 46% said Rihanna was responsible for what happened, despite knowing that her injuries required hospital treatment. A post by Jill on the blog Feministe explains the response of girls in the survey by comparing it to self-defensive victim blaming in sexual assault cases. If you can pin the responsibility for the violence on something the woman did, you can live without the fear that someone might harm you in a similar way. If you convince yourself that women get raped because they go somewhere they shouldn't, or because they dress in a particular way, or because they drink too much, or because they have a bad reputation, then it's easy enough to convince yourself that if you just act right, you'll be safe. If you convince yourself that women get beaten because they talk back or because they instigate the violence with physical aggression or because they otherwise bring violence upon themselves, then it's easy enough to convince yourself that you won't ever end up getting beaten. End quote. Andy Wright on Alternet critiques those who said that in continuing the relationship, Rihanna is condoning the behavior of abusive partners. But, he writes, Rihanna's treatment at the hands of the press will be more damaging to domestic abuse victims than her behavior ever could be. Casting Rihanna as the willing victim and summarily revoking sympathy as a means of punishing her for a perceived complacency sends a clear message that women who are victims of abuse deserve compassion on a conditional basis only. Victims should speak out, but only if they are ready to leave their partner and, better still, engage in legal retaliation. This, of course, ignores the fact that many women suffer the same kind of re-victimization in court that Rihanna is currently suffering at the hands of the press. If victims of domestic violence are taking any message away from this fracas, it's that once other people become aware of your situation, you open yourself up to criticism and contempt. End quote. But even the alternate writers, who are clearly trying to advance an intelligent and empathetic discussion of the problem, shy away from addressing the politics of the problem of domestic violence. While Wright's argument hints that legal retaliation might not be the only or best response, he stops short of addressing those limitations more explicitly. In an essay in the collection Nobody Passes, Priya Kandaswamy points out that the success of the battered women's movement has proven to be a double-edged sword. In order to gain public support, domestic violence advocates portrayed abused women as innocent victims who suffered at the hands of particularly deviant men. While this narrative perhaps sought to combat the idea that abuse was a woman's fault, it drew upon dominant ideas of innocence and victimhood and required that women represent themselves in particular ways in order to be recognized as deserving of assistance. This requirement to pass as a good victim reinforced dominant gender norms and also marginalized women of color, immigrant women, working-class women, homeless women, lesbians, gay men, transgender people, and anyone who did not or could not fit these norms. Perhaps even more insidiously, these kinds of legislative engagements with the state have increasingly come to pass as the only kind of real or acceptable politics. Under the rubric of helping real victims of real crimes, approaches that emphasize criminalization and rehabilitation have usurped critiques that sought to change how power is distributed in society, and have naturalized the process of criminalizing violence against women and seeking expanded state funding for services for battered women as the only available political approaches to the problem. End quote. As the Alternet staff note, it's now more important than ever to shed light on domestic violence because the economic meltdown is likely to drive up the incidence of abuse. The National Domestic Abuse Hotline documented a 21% increase in calls for September 2008 over the same month in 2007. And although research shows that recession and unemployment don't cause spousal abuse by themselves, they do exacerbate situations where violence is already a factor. But some activists and progressives are looking for other ways to address problems of intimate violence. Portland's Dicentra Collective, for instance, on which KABU has reported here on The Old Mole, as well as on Circle A and Positively Revolting Talk Radio, has been working on harm reduction approaches to intimate violence and creating safer spaces. Those interested in reducing family violence may also want to take note of next month's event on child abuse prevention, offered by Listen to Kids, and in other words, Women's Books and Resources. Rather than imagining that abuse is only real when it happens to a suitably innocent victim at the hands of a particularly deviant man, we need to continue seeking not only to reduce violence, but also to change how power is distributed in society. For The Old Mole, this has been Fran Michel.
Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. Always come late if they come at all.
That was Tracy Chapman, Behind the Wall, her protest against domestic violence. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KABU. 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. Archie Greene, a name even many people on the left are probably not familiar with, was America's most prominent scholar of labor-related folklore. Archie, as he's universally known, was a scholar of what he called labor lore, the expressive culture of working people. For 5 decades, he studied hillbilly music and pile drivers' tales and the culture of working people. He made inventories of tin men, the showpieces of sheet metal workers, and analyzed sailors' slang. He recorded songs by mill workers and miners' wives. Working on until just months before his death, he wrote countless articles, both academic and popular, and 5 books, including Onia Minor, his landmark study of coal mining music. Last weekend, Greene, often called the grandfather of labor history, passed away in his San Francisco home at the age of 91. Archie Greene was a shipwright turned folklorist whose interest in union workers and their culture transformed the study of American folklore. Greene drew on a childhood enthusiasm for cowboy songs and a devotion to the union movement to conduct a singular academic career. Returning to college at age 40, he began studying what he called labor lore, the work song slang, craft techniques, and tales that helped to define the trade unions and create a sense of group identity. At the same time, Mr. Green energetically promoted the idea of public folklore. That is, the folklorist should work outside the academy to gather, preserve, and publicize local cultures through government agencies, museums, folk festivals, and radio stations. His signal achievement in this area was the lonely lobbying campaign he conducted for nearly 6 years to create a National Folklife Center, which became a reality when Congress, by unanimous vote, passed the American Folklife Preservation Act, signed into law by President Ford in January 1976. Mr. Green was born Aaron Green in Winnipeg, Manitoba. His father had fled Cherganov in present-day Ukraine after taking part in the failed 1905 Russian Revolution. When he was a small boy, the family moved to Los Angeles, where he listened to cowboy songs on the radio, absorbed socialist politics from his father, and developed a passionate dedication to the labor union movement and the New Deal. After earning a degree in political science from the University of California, Berkeley, Mr. Green decided to throw in his lot with the working class. He joined the Civilian Conservation Corps, working as a road builder and firefighter along the Klamath River, and became a shipwright and union activist on the San Francisco waterfront. For the rest of his life, he identified himself first and foremost as a worker and a union member. After serving as a Navy Seabee during World War II, Mr. Green returned to the waterfront, but later switched to carpentry. As the union movement lost some of its energy, he went back to academia, enrolling at the University of Illinois to become a labor historian. There, as an advisor to the campus folk music club, he sent students out into the field to record the indigenous music of central and southern Illinois and wrote a seminal article, Hillbilly Music, Source and Symbol. He went on to earn a doctorate in folklore at the University of Pennsylvania. His dissertation on the songs of Kentucky coal miners was published in 1972 as Only a Miner. His approach to occupational folklore was not far short of revolutionary. It's been said that before Archie, the field did not have a clear vision of what occupational folklore was. There was a huge disconnect between academics, who took a literary, almost 19th century view of what folklore was, and someone like Archie, who wanted to tell the pile driver or the auto worker, you have your own culture that is unique, that no other occupation has. Green's most recent publication is the Big Red Songbook, featuring the lyrics to the 190 songs included in the various editions of the Little Red Songbooks from 1909 to 1973 by the Industrial Workers of the World, the Wobblies. Green inherited this project from John Newhouse, a machinist and IWW member who devoted years to collecting a nearly complete set of the IWW songbooks and determining what music the songs had been set to. When Newhouse died of cancer in 1958, he gave his unique collection of songbooks, sheet music, and other materials to Green, who vowed to carry on Newhouse's vision of a complete edition of the IWW songs. In his final months, Mr. Green continued to organize and agitate, issuing directives from his deathbed to colleagues and friends. His pet project was to convince Congress that it should, as in the days of the New Deal and the Works Progress Administration, set aside money for artists, filmmakers, photographers, writers, and yes, folklorists, to document the projects put into motion by the stimulus bill. This piece has been called principally from his obituary in Sunday's New York Times, as well as various websites. If you want to learn more about Archie Green, simply do a web search for his name. Now, what could be more appropriate than to play a song from the Little Red Songbook? This is The Preacher and the Slave by Michael Hurley.
Long-haired preachers come out every night. They will tell you what's wrong and what's right. Do you ask them for something to eat? They'll tell you with voices so sweet. Thank you. sky, work and pray.
Closing out our program today, Laura Mercier is here in the studio with Jorge Lizarraga, an urban planning specialist from UC Berkeley, currently completing a study at WSU Vancouver on the demographic impact of urban planning theories and city planning policies on the ethnic and racial makeup of Portland.
Thanks, Tom. Jorge Lizarraga is a human geographer and currently diversity faculty fellow at WSU Vancouver. And before moving to the Pacific Northwest, Jorge was on the Geography and Ethnic Studies faculty at California Polytechnic State University, San Luis Obispo. And as Tom mentioned, he's finishing his PhD in geography at the University of California, Berkeley, focusing on the influence of urban design theories and city planning policies on the racial geography of Portland. Welcome to KBOO, Jorge.
Well, thank you for having me.
Jorge, last month, Mayor Sam Adams led the city council in a 4-1 vote approving the biggest, most car-friendly option to widen the I-5 bridges spanning the Columbia River to Vancouver, Washington, 12 lanes. The Columbia River Crossing is the biggest public works project in our region's history, and it's projected to cost a whopping $4 billion. A number of community groups have protested the environmental and health costs of the plan, including the Coalition for a Livable Future, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, and the Environmental Justice Action Group, but their voices have largely been excluded and overpowered by the steamroller of development. And in fact, the mayor and council refused to support Commissioner Amanda Fritz's modest green amendment to the Big Bridge proposal to include environmental justice advocates on a new bridge management committee. And Jorge, as you have found in your research, there's a long history of excluding low-income voices and neighborhoods in planning and designing public projects in Portland. So tell us about who won and who lost in some earlier projects that most of us have probably long associated with the built environment in Portland, but know little about the origins.
Well, City of Portland today, of course, is known as a standout example of what's supposed to be good planning policy and execution. And to be sure, the City of Portland has had some amazing successes revitalizing its downtown, its mass transit system, that are absolutely worthy of praising and recognizing. But this latest type of planning is, of course, just the latest in urban planning policy the city has had from almost its the beginning of the 20th century. And at different times, like with any kind of important policy, there are unforeseen consequences. In terms of urban planning in particular, the first serious ideas of what Portland ought to look like as designed by urban planners really come at the turn of the century. And at that time, the city was undergoing economic growth, but it was also facing some social and economic movements that were also impacting other urban areas. But essentially, it was an idea of trying to shape the city to face a growing economic complexity, sort of competing social movements and so on. And throughout the period, the economic imperatives of real estate development, industry, and so on came first and foremost. They were going to be paying for the different implementations of the plans. Businessmen in those days, there was no city planning department as such. Economic leaders actually would hire outside consultants to come up with possible plans. And in Portland, that meant hiring the best, and that meant essentially hiring folks who were behind the City Beautiful movement and so on.
Mm-hmm. And then later, in the post-war period, post-World War II, federal money became available for cities in their development projects. So tell us about one of the first big development projects.
Well, with the Great Depression and World War II in particular, a growing role for federal monies in local and regional and state government, of course, became available. And these were especially true when it came to local planning projects. And by the end of the war, as the war was winding down, people were trying to imagine what America would look like in the aftermath of the war, particularly how the cities would be shaped. People wondered if some cities might actually be abandoned because of the rapid loss of wartime jobs and so on. So there was this interesting interest in urban planning and renewal for the cities after the war. And Portland was no different. By the 1950s, Portland was examining a variety of different options. They had had several sort of homegrown ideas on planning, but began to implement them through the 1950s.
And you have written about the South Auditorium Project, which is one of these first big projects to actually demolish neighborhoods.
Well, that's right. The South Auditorium Project was Portland's first large-scale redevelopment project. And it's actually a project that changed much of Portland, and most people take the landscape that it created for granted. It essentially affected the areas from Clay heading towards the Ross Island Bridge and adjacent to Portland State University up to basically the riverfront. And that had been, up until the 1950s, one of Portland's more important ethnic neighborhoods. It was strongly Italian-American and Jewish. The famed painter Mark Rothko grew up in that area. He went to Lincoln High School before moving to New York and carry on his painting career. But it was a thriving community. But in the 1950s, it was slated for redevelopment, which meant two things, really. First, the urban redevelopment of the neighborhood itself, but also clearing of the neighborhood for the interstate projects that were coming through, including Interstate 5 and especially 405 later. These were two actually different federal government programs, but they worked hand in hand, federal government transportation program and the redevelopment urban funding that was coming through.
And how did those neighborhoods react to those proposals? Did they have any voice in where those freeway plans were directed and so on?
Well, through the 1950s, large-scale urban planning policies and politics mirrored what was happening in the rest of the country. It was a time period where the federal government was quite strong. People believed in essentially a top-down planning and other federal type approach to government policy. And it was essentially the old notion of the greatest good for the greatest numbers. And there really, quite frankly, wasn't too much attention paid to the well-being of the residents. Some folks were pushed out, depending on the particular federal program, with some monies to relocate. Others had to vacate altogether. In fact, it was kind of the treatment of these kinds of neighborhoods, not just in Portland, but in New York, in Chicago, in Boston, and so on, that started a reaction against the large redevelopment projects, including here in Portland. People were beginning to grasp the ideas and accept the ideas of people like Lewis Mumford and, of course, Jane Jacobs. And with the political activism, particularly coming from the neighborhoods in the 1960s, people began to question these large-scale projects, beginning first with large-scale transportation and interstate projects, and then on through the neighborhood redevelopment projects.
And then Neil Goldschmidt is one of these who's mobilizing people against some of these projects, such as the Mount Hood Freeway that was planned to bisect much of southeast Portland.
That's right. In fact, throughout the country, the Mount Hood Freeway is considered one of the early important successes in stopping a large-scale project. There had been others in Boston, in San Francisco. Mayor Arliotto had stopped the Embarcadero Freeway and so on. And Goldschmidt, first as a neighborhood activist and then on the city council, and of course as mayor, effectively ended that project. The concern, of course, was that the freeway was going to displace thousands of residents, was going to divide up the city. and that essentially neighborhood folks hadn't been consulted on these projects that were going to affect so much of their lives. And so it proved an effective strategy to stop the freeway, and you began to get a new kind of urban planning that emphasized participation by local folks. And as mayor, of course, Goldschmidt is known for a new type of urban planning.
But as you find that some groups were more successful than others in having a voice in that planning, and there were some other projects that actually wiped out entire neighborhoods in Northeast Portland, including the plan for Legacy Hospital and so on.
Well, that's correct. Even before Neil Goldschmidt had become mayor and even been on the city council, there were already clearance projects in Northeast Portland. The clearance for the Memorial Stadium, for example, and what would become the Rose Quarter was underway in the early 60s. That was part of the legacy of those top-down type of projects from before. The massive clearance of Northeast Portland for the construction of I-5, and related to that was the building and development of the Convention Center area and especially the Lloyd Center. All these impacted the most concentrated area of the city with African Americans. It was essentially the community for African Americans in the Portland area. It was a vital economic and cultural area. And so all that was underway before Goldschmidt became mayor. And there were effective plans put in to continue the leveling for expansion of the Emmanuel Legacy Hospital. Goldschmidt didn't draw up those plans necessarily, but they were carried out under his administration. And so ironically, while Goldschmidt came to power effectively fighting the clearing of neighborhoods and putting a stop to large-scale projects that would do that, under his administration, the area around Williams and Russell got cleared out, as many blocks did, in anticipation of federal monies that wound up not coming and left the area devastated. It wiped out the core of what was left of the African-American business district in that particular neighborhood and, of course, displaced many residents as well.
This is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO, and I'm speaking with Jorge Lizárraga about the history of city planning policies on the racial geography of Portland. And Jorge, just in light of that kind of devastation that was inflicted upon the African-American neighborhoods of Northeast Portland, I mean, what does this say about the process of planning and where individuals such as Neil Goldschmidt might have had sympathies with neighborhood groups, this whole structure of the economy and federal money coming into an area tends to almost act like a steamroller, I used that metaphor earlier, in pushing out critical voices.
Well, that's one of the contradictions of the kinds of planning policies Portland has had. On the one hand, you had Goldschmidt promoting a progressive agenda, doing some amazing things to stop the freeway construction, to expand mass transit for the city. He became well known for that, of course. He appointed people from the community in his position, pushed community activism involvement in the planning policy. But at the end of the day, the imperatives of local developers and interests sort of still won out in that the Emmanuel clearance continued on. And, of course, just the market forces that would lead to Portland to be successful in some of these material things led to a revitalization of the housing markets and so on that led to, of course, an accelerated gentrification of the Northeast, which of course we're seeing since the 90s, pushing even more African American residents out of the area.
And as you said, the imperatives of capital tend to force actions in certain directions.
That's right. I mean, urban planning as a profession has a lot to celebrate in terms of how it's able to change direction, come up with new ideas, fascinating approaches, and so on. On the other hand, They're also not necessarily the leaders in urban development. They're usually coming in to fulfill some interests or planning need that's really set by folks outside of the planning profession. And politicians are in that mix as much as anyone else is.
We have just another minute, Jorge, but are there any stories that you can, or examples from Portland's history where you could just sort of quickly tell us how people have successfully mobilized to shape the planning process?
Well,
lessons that might help guide activists today.
Well, actually, Portland has one of the best examples of any city I know of where people early on put a stop to it. At the height of this sort of top-down planning, Northwest Portland was slated to be actually Portland's first redevelopment project, the Vaughan Street Project. And local activists there, essentially a working-class community, came together and with coalition politics put a stop to what was supposed to be that first clearance. Essentially, all of Northwest Portland along 23rd Street and at Vaughan was essentially going to be cleared out and changed completely from what it looks like today. And that successful resistance allowed that vital community not only to survive and eventually thrive the way it has today, but it's a great model that other folks might want to look into a little more and see how we can come together and challenge these things.
Thanks so much for joining us today, Jorge Lizárraga. And this is Laurie Mercier for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Well, thank you, Laurie and Jorge. That completes our program for today. This has been the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Steve has been our engineer. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. And don't forget, this program will be podcast on the KBOO website in the next day or two. You can find links to more information about guests and topics on the web pages for the show.